From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a $51 million helping hand from the Kellogg Foundation to Battle Creek Public Schools.
We are really trying to shore up the gap in our funding to allow us an opportunity to truly meet the needs of the children that we serve.
Crunching the numbers at the revenue sharing conference today in Lansing.
It is actually kind of glamorous if you are a policy, a government nerd.
A Michigan woman shares the agonizing decision she and her husband made to have an abortion at 21 weeks.
I chose my own suffering over the suffering of my child. And I think that is what a mother does, is she makes choice on behalf of her children when they can't make it for themselves.
And the Bath School bombing 90 years ago tomorrow.
There was a massive explosion. Now, people thought the boiler had blown up.
But first, the news. Abortion. A complicated, extremely divisive issue in our country, and especially when it comes to so-called late-term abortions.
It's really important that people understand that women aren't just waiting till they're halfway through their pregnancy and deciding for some reason they just don't care, they don't want it. They are faced with a choice, and it is the most difficult choice.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Later this hour, a Michigan woman shares the agonizing decision that she and her husband made to have an abortion at 21 weeks. But first, Michigan's school choice policy has opened the door for thousands and thousands of parents to take their kids out of their homeschool districts and go to schools in neighboring districts. That shift of students from mainly poorer urban districts to better-off suburban schools has caused segregation and big financial challenges for urban districts. Take Battle Creek Public Schools, where shrinking enrollment meant a $20 million cut in state funding. A 2016 study by Bridge Magazine found Battle Creek loses more than 4 of 10 students to schools outside the district, typically white and more affluent. But there's a big helping hand on the way. The Kellogg Foundation has promised $51 million over the next 5 years to help the struggling Battle Creek Public Schools. It's a groundbreaking example of philanthropy helping public education. Here with us, the superintendent of Battle Creek Public Schools, Kim Carter. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Kim, what has the loss of students and the money meant for your district? What has it forced you to do?
Well, the biggest part of this is an understanding that with the loss of students, it means the loss of revenue, which also means that we have a lack of resources that are needed to fully educate and fully fund all of the programs that we have within the district.
That $20 million is a big hit.
A large hit, and we have continued to have declining enrollment over the past 10 years, which have created an operating deficit that has continued to cause challenges when we're trying to create opportunities for the kids that we serve.
Certainly. What kinds of cuts have you been forced to make?
Well, a variety of them. We all know that the first thing that schools normally cut are all of the ancillary or enrichment programs that we're able to offer. One of the little-known facts is that Battle Creek Public Schools owns and operates an outdoor education center at Clear Lake Camp. And as a result of our declining revenue, we've been unable to provide those experiences that we had the opportunity to provide in the past. So, for example, our kindergartners would go out for Baby Animal Farm, and we'd provide overnight stays for our fifth graders and our sixth graders. And as our revenue has decreased, we've had to eliminate much of that programming. We've also cut some of our arts and other enrichment opportunities as well. Our class sizes have increased as a result of declining enrollment. And we've lost the ability to have those extra supports for students in the form of literacy interventionists and those other opportunities.
It's such a catch-22 because the declining enrollment and therefore declining revenues, you have to make cuts, which of course sends more kids elsewhere. So this commitment from the Kellogg Foundation could break that cycle, that catch-22.
That's the intention. We are really trying to shore up the gap in our funding to allow us an opportunity to truly meet the needs of the children that we serve and to make sure that each and every child that comes through our doors has access to a high-quality, effective education.
Now, this commitment of $51 million has caught attention everywhere. It's an astonishing amount of cash.
It is, and it's over the next 5 years. So we will be using the funds to truly implement a comprehensive plan that will fundamentally transform Battle Creek Public Schools. What is the most important thing is that this contribution or investment is designed to target every grade level, every student, and every school.
So what kinds of things might this money enable you to do?
So, for example, we'll be able to provide targeted supports for our students. And what that looks like is we will be placing literacy interventionists back into our early elementary classrooms so that students who are struggling with developing their basic skills will have some expert instruction and smaller group opportunities. The other thing that we're really excited about is an investment in our preschool children. We're going to offer a 5-day, 5-week preschool summer school program that helps our children become more ready for kindergarten as they are coming into the classroom. We will also be revising our middle school experience by offering social-emotional supports and social skills training and advisory classes that help them build stronger connections to their peers as well as the staff.
And what about in high school?
High school, we're also touching the high school as well. We'll be implementing an early college program as early as the fall, and we're creating college pathways where our high school will be divided into smaller learning communities that are closely connected to the career goals of the students. So, for example, we're going to be opening the College of Health and Human Services. So students that are enrolled in that pathway will have more opportunities to engage in internships, hands-on, and experiential learning opportunities.
Kim, I'm real interested in just what led to this huge commitment from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. I mean, did you ask for $51 million? Did Kellogg offer it? How did this happen?
So it starts with the design of a plan, and I am very honored and humbled by the fact that they believe in the plan that was presented to them. And so this funding is really designed to fully implement a strategic plan that I began working with community members and other stakeholders over a year ago. But what was in the way of actually implementing that was the lack of funding. So approximately a year ago, we came up with the 6 goals to greatness. We clearly and intentionally identified the steps and the strategies that it would take to actually transform outcomes for students, but didn't have the resources to fully implement that plan. We were kind of taking a piecemeal approach to prioritizing the things that we could do based upon the funding that we have. So writing out that plan and being triggered by the report from New York University, that caught the ear of the foundation. And after catching their ear, I was able to tell them my vision for how we would want to transform this district and our complete plan for how we intended to do so, put numbers to that, and very humbled and honored to have the opportunity to fully implement.
And that study done by New York University, what was the gist of that study, Kim?
It really highlighted the inequities that exist within this community and brought to light some of the barriers and challenges that the students in Battle Creek Public Schools are facing. As a result of school choice and the opportunities that some of the students have access to and others do not, we have created concentrated populations of vulnerable students. And that study highlighted that that concentration of vulnerable students requires access to additional resources in order to ensure that they achieve.
And Kellogg bought into it, and now $51 million over 5 years. What would you have done if you did not get this money?
We would still be implementing that strategic plan, but we would have to do it over a longer period of time. It would be a very arduous process. And we would continue to make cuts and have to make some very difficult decisions about what we can do and what we would not be able to do.
Kim, what does this say more largely about the state of public education in Michigan, that a major city's public school district needs such major, major help from a private foundation in order to thrive?
So what I think the most important thing to note is that we need a total overhaul of our school finance and funding practices, that we truly have to look at those districts who are serving vulnerable children and ask ourselves the question of whether or not we are fully funding equitable opportunities for all of the children that we serve.
Kim Carter, Battle Creek School Superintendent, we want to thank you so much, and we will be, I'm sure, checking in with you as this gets up and running over the next 5 years with this big, big infusion of $51 million from the Kellogg Foundation. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Kim.
Thank you. I look forward to celebrating our success.
Most will agree it has been a crazy few days in Washington, D.C. The latest development involving President Donald Trump, now ex-FBI Director James Comey, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and Russia broke last night. The New York Times reported Comey kept notes and memos of his private meetings and conversations with Trump. The memos allegedly claim the president asked Comey to stop the federal investigation into Trump's former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn. Most Democrats have been calling for an independent investigation. That includes both of Michigan's senators who did so last week on Stateside. We reached out to each of Michigan's 9 Republican congressmen asking for their views on the latest developments. None agreed to join us for an interview. However, we have a post up at MichiganRadio.org. You can go there and find out what all of Michigan's congressional delegation has said publicly about this latest development. Coming up, crunching numbers at the revenue sharing conference today in Lansing.
It is actually kind of glamorous if you are a policy, a government nerd.
Plus, the Bath School bombing 90 years ago tomorrow, an awful tragedy, and it could have been even worse.
They found another 500 pounds of dynamite and a World War I surplus explosive called pyrrhotol. Had it all gone off, Bath would have been wiped off the map. 600 pounds of dynamite would have been a devastating explosion beyond, of course, the devastation, you know, of the children who died that day.
That's after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
Tomorrow marks the ugly anniversary of one of the worst mass killings in United States history. No, not the massacres that happened at Virginia Tech or Sandy Hook, but rather the massacre that happened in the small rural town of Bath, Michigan, right near Lansing. By day's end, on May 18th, 1927, 38 elementary school children and 6 adults were dead and nearly 60 others injured. Here now to remember this very dark chapter in Michigan history is Rachel Clark with the Michigan History Center and Arnie Bernstein. His book is Bath Massacre, America's First School Bombing. Welcome, both of you, to Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rachel, it seems that this awful event has kind of slipped way back in the sands of time. I mean, when we have the news stories that follow tragedies like Sandy Hook, it's rarely, if ever, mentioned. Why do you think it has been so forgotten?
I think part of that was due to the community itself. Bath worked very, very hard after the events of that horrible spring day to sort of try to forget and not necessarily push it aside, but to not necessarily keep reliving it. They worked very diligently to remove the school very quickly, to bury their dead very quickly, and worked very hard to remove any actual signs of Andrew Kehoe himself. So I think that was part of it. It was just too painful to keep it in everybody's view at the time.
Yes, and sands of time do have an effect. Arnie, this is a very, very weighty topic, but let's start at the very beginning with the murderer, Andrew Philip Kehoe. What were his early years like, and how is it he came to live in Bath?
Kehoe was a real enigma. His upbringing included a father who had remarried a woman who was young enough to be Kehoe's sister. He was trained in electricity, in how to harness electricity, which was a relatively new technology at the time in the late 1800s. He was in St. Louis when he was studying and was zapped and put in a coma for about 2 weeks. Did this have an effect on him? Hard to say. There was a terrible accident where his stepmother, who Kehoe had a contentious relationship, was killed when the oven exploded on her. Kehoe's behavior was quite odd afterward. He went to the neighbor next door and asked if she had a phone. He said, well, Franny's been burned. Can I use your phone? And by the way, call a priest. Did Kehoe set the explosive to go off? He certainly had the technical know-how, but there's no way of knowing one way or other. It's often been speculated that he did do this. And he married Nellie Price, who was the niece of a prominent politician in the Lansing-Bath area. And they moved to her childhood home in Bath.
So that brought him to Bath. And he became involved in Bath schools?
Yes. They had no children. But he felt if his taxes were going to pay for the school, he had the right to be a member of the school board. And he certainly was within his rights and was appointed treasurer of the school board. His books were meticulous when it came to balancing the checks, balancing the money. But he often got into arguments with Emery Hike, who was the superintendent of the school system in Bath. If things weren't going Kehoe's way during a board meeting, he would demand that the board meeting come to an end and he would leave.
Not a way to make friends.
No. I've worked in education, you know, for a long time. This is not unusual for school board meetings. It happens. There are often contentious personalities involved. So there was really nothing in that behavior that would suggest that Kehoe was capable of what he did.
So, Rachel, after serving a few years on the Bath School Board, Kehoe was appointed temporarily as clerk for Bath in 1925, and then he was defeated in the spring election in 1926. Was that the time people began noticing some odd behavior by Kehoe?
Yes, his behavior, he seems a little more negative, a little more bleak. And they also start to notice he is purchasing more and more explosives, some from Lansing, some from the local dealerships. So there are a few things, but that's not unusual for a farmer back in the 20s. You have rocks, you have stumps. Other farmers would go to him for advice or even for explosive materials to help remove stumps from their farms or whatever's in the middle of their land they need removed. So in hindsight, they sort of looked back as unusual behaviors at the time. It was sort of strange, but not necessarily anything that stood out.
Arnie Bernstein, take us to May 18th, 1927. How did that day begin in Bath?
The day began with the boiler not working at the school. He had access to the school because he was a handyman. He knew how to fix things. And because he was on the Board of Trustees, he had a key. He could get in, come and go as his will. He was called in to take a look at the boiler. Now, he was really flustered and didn't want to work on it and finally just up and left. Shortly thereafter, there was a massive explosion. Now, people thought the boiler had blown up. The school itself, the north wing of the school, came down. Basically, the building collapsed. The second story fell on top of the first story. Meanwhile, at about the same time, Kehoe's farm started a blaze. People had no idea what was going on. They saw some sort of incredible disaster had happened at the school, and Kehoe's farm was purely coincidence. Kehoe drove up to the school in his truck. Now, before he left his farm, a couple of his neighbors were there. They wanted to know what was going on, and he said, boys, you're my friends. You better get out of here. You better go down to the school. And he drove off to the school. Now, before he pulled up, he tipped his hat to a child who was crossing the street, running from the scene. And then he drove up to the front of the school, which was just devastation. There was triage in front of the school. There was a morgue that was slowly growing. People were literally clawing with their hands trying to get the kids out of there. They didn't have heavy tools. Houses were turning into, you know, hospitals. It was just absolute chaos. And when Kehoe pulled up, he confronted Emery Hike. Hike saw him and said, we need your truck. We need to go get ladders. We need to go get ropes. Kehoe looked at him and said, okay, I'll take you with me. And Hike got a look of horror on his face and said, you know something about this, don't you?
Oh, interesting that he just pulled a vibe out of that.
He just knew, gut feeling, absolute horror in his face. And at that point, Kehoe blew up his truck and taking both him and Hike, the two of them were just blown to pieces, and other people were hit by the debris. He had packed the cab of his truck with old nails, old implements, rusty screws, things like that. And the shrapnel killed a couple of other people and wounded many others.
Wow. And then back to the farm. Tell us, what was on the sign that was found afterward at Kehoe's farm?
There was a sign found lashed to his farm. Stenciled said, criminals are made, not born. In other words, you made me do this.
Oof. Were there signs later in the day that investigators realized the day could have been even worse?
Yes. They estimated that about 100 pounds of dynamite had gone off under the north wing of the school that had collapsed. But as they did investigation, they saw that there was massive wiring under the main part of the school, and they found another 500 pounds of dynamite and a World War I surplus explosive called pyrrhotol. Had it all gone off, Bath would have been wiped off the map. 600 pounds of dynamite would have been a devastating explosion beyond, of course, the devastation that, you know, of the children who died that day.
Wow. Wow. What was the reaction nationally in the days that followed?
Well, initially, there was an outpouring, and people would send money, send, you know, all kinds of help to Bath. And then 3 days afterwards, after the bombing, Charles Lindbergh took off for Paris. And suddenly, Bath was no longer a story. Keep in mind, this is the days before CNN and Internet, and we had mass coverage. But it was largely pushed off the front page. Of course, Bath was isolated at the time. They didn't even have electricity. Electricity was being strung into Bath that day, the day the explosion happened. Some places had generators. The school had a generator for electricity. Kehoe had a generator for electricity. But because it was so isolated, you know, the story was, I won't say forgotten, but it was put aside because the country and the world went Lindy happy. And I think in a way that was probably the best thing that could have happened, because it gave the people time and space to mourn.
That does make sense. Rachel, the Michigan History Center has a pretty amazing artifact from the Bath Massacre. Tell us what that is.
We do. Shortly after the bombing, one of the school board members and also a blacksmith in town donated the watch that Andrew Kehoe was wearing at the time that he blew up his car. So the Michigan History Center has that watch. It is just a regular old pocket watch. The hour hand is missing, but the minute hand sets at 13 minutes after the hour, which was purportedly when Andrew Kehoe blew up his truck. I don't know if it froze at that minute, if somebody set it to that minute after the fact, but that's how we received it. So the Michigan History Center, has had that artifact since about a month after the bombing.
Rachel, what about motive? Was Andrew Kehoe the 1920s version of what we call today a lone wolf?
I don't know that I would say that. Andrew Kehoe clearly was mentally ill. I don't want to say it's a simple answer, but that is the case. When the town was sort of reviewing what happened, a lot of the blame went to the consolidation of schools. Andrew Kehoe's farm was actually in foreclosure, and he was very upset at the fact that he had to pay taxes to build this large school in town as opposed to paying for the smaller country schools. And so he did sort of rail on about the taxes and how it was hurting his farm. So that is sort of the explanation that people gave. But the reality is he was mentally ill, and he actually acted out on one of the worst disasters in our nation's history.
Arnie Bernstein, as the one who wrote the book Bath Massacre, America's First School Bombing, anything you want to add or anything you want us to understand about what it was that happened that day?
Well, I think the most important lesson that we can get out of Bath is, yes, there was this horrible devastation, and a man who epitomized evil just took out his internal rage, whatever motivated him, on a whole generation of children. But what came out of it was people turning to each other. And it's the kind of thing we saw after 9/11, after Sandy Hook, after any huge, terrible thing like this. People came together. Community came together as a whole, and they worked with themselves and help that arrived from other places. I can't say it's healing, but they helped each other. It was out of great horror, out of great evil, came something really beautiful that people rely on each other, and that could not be wiped out by Kehoe.
Tomorrow, marking the ugly anniversary of one of the worst mass killings in U.S. history, we've been speaking with the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark and with Arnie Bernstein. His book is Bath Massacre, America's First School Bombing. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It is number crunching time in Lansing at today's revenue estimating conference, where officials figure out how much money will be available before they firm up the state budget for 2017-2018. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is here with us. Rick, this seems like kind of the not so glamorous nitty gritty work of running the state. What actually goes on at this revenue estimating conference?
I'll push back a little bit on that, Cindy. It is actually kind of glamorous if you are a policy, a government nerd. And, you know, corporate boards actually pay good money to assemble this kind of talent to come in and talk to them about what's going on in the state and the national economies, what's happening with housing, with the auto industry, what's happening with revenue and tax collections, what are we seeing in terms of people's buying habits, what's happening with employment and underemployment, and things like that. And so what happens is experts, mostly economists, come in and talk about all those things. Also, legislative budget experts come in and talk about what they see happening with the state revenue picture, what's happening with the income tax, what's happening with sales taxes, with business taxes, and how much the state's going to come in. And then what happens is all of those recommendations and all of that data go into the hopper, and the chiefs of the House Fiscal Agency, the Senate Fiscal Agency, and these are nonpartisan agencies, sort of the legislature's versions of the Congressional Budget Office, and the state treasury, and they come up with a number. And then, well, we can hear from State Budget Director Al Pasholka what happens next.
Kind of gives us a roadmap to complete the budget. That's what I'm, you know, I'm not the architect, I'm the carpenter. So I'm trying to get the budget done in June. I think this gives us a good roadmap to get the budget done in early June.
So what kind of projections did we hear today, Rick?
Some good news and some not so good news. That the bad news is the general fund, which is sort of the state's main checkbook. That's where the legislature has most of its discretionary money, money that's not mandated by law or the Constitution to be used for something, or federal funds that are earmarked for a particular purpose. That the general fund, the discretionary fund, is about $290 million short of what they were expecting when they started out. And that matters in part because you might remember from our reporting that we've talked about how Republicans in the legislature have been shaving down Governor Snyder's budget proposal in order to come up with money to maybe do something regarding teacher pensions or an income tax cut or rebate, things like that. And this makes it that much less possible. However, on the flip side, we have seen the other big fund that legislators control, the school aid fund. Well, that has about $340 million more than they expected. And so that is, as we head into June and the hope of getting the budget done by then, some sticky political fights in Lansing.
Yes. Do we know why the number is down for the general fund revenues?
It's all about which revenue streams are feeding which bank account, either the general fund or the school aid fund. And so income taxes were not as robust as was expected. Business taxes, at least some of them, were kind of flat. And so that meant that even though there was a little bit of growth, it wasn't as much growth as they were expecting back in January, right about the time that Governor Snyder was preparing his budget proposal. Sales taxes doing better than expected, and so that money goes into the school aid fund, and so that's why we're seeing more than expected there.
Might we see lawmakers try to shift some of that school aid fund revenue over to the general fund, and how would that be received?
It absolutely sets up a fight, one that has persisted throughout the Snyder administration, on raiding the school aid fund for universities. And that this is something that, while it's allowed under the state constitution, before Governor Snyder, it really wasn't done. And a lot of legislators and certainly school officials have been trying to block that in different ways. So we will see, no doubt, a fight over using school aid money for universities instead of taking that from the general fund.
Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief, Rick Pluta. As always, Rick, thanks so much.
As always, it's a pleasure.
Still to come, why Rachel Redmond is taking the rare step of talking about her abortion.
If we get to know the people we think are the other, we think are the enemy, we feel like we hate, we learn that we probably won't hate them so much.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Abortion is a complicated, divisive topic in this country, especially when abortion takes place later in a pregnancy. Rachel Redman aborted a wanted pregnancy at 21 weeks, which some states consider an illegal later-term abortion. Now, here in Michigan, the law doesn't use a strict cutoff time, so the definition of late-term is more complex and nuanced. But that has not stopped procedures like Rachel's from being controversial. Rachel Redman is taking the rare step of talking openly about her abortion with us, hoping to put a face on this challenging issue. She and I spoke about 6 months after she underwent the procedure. The conversation tends to focus on unwanted pregnancy, but that was not your story. Can you talk to us some about your decision to get pregnant?
So I had known I wanted to be pregnant for a long time, but I was in graduate school and my husband and I decided to wait until I was through with my program and through with my board exams. And so when the time came to get pregnant, I was very excited and I got pregnant very quickly. And we were just ecstatic. Everything was going according to plan. All of my ultrasounds, the early ultrasounds were perfect, and I was feeling really great, except for the the nausea, the
not feeling so great things about
pregnancy.
The not
feeling so great, but even those things felt great because I was just so happy to be pregnant. And yeah, everything was going perfectly until we went to that anatomy scan, which most women do at 20 weeks. I had mine at 19 just because of scheduling purposes, and we found out in that early ultrasound, or in that 20-week ultrasound, that we were having a boy. We were so excited, and we had several hours of just being happy about our little baby boy until the doctor called and told us that she found the scan showed multiple fetal anomalies and that we would have to go in for genetic testing.
Now, what was that moment like to get that call from your doctor?
That moment was crushing, but it was also very surreal. It didn't seem real. It just seemed like this isn't happening, and I'm just going to think positively and not lose hope because it was out of the blue. It was out of nowhere. Everything was going smoothly, and I hadn't realized the importance of that 20-week scan, what the doctors were looking for in those scans.
So you had to go in for some more testing?
Yes. So several days later, I got an appointment with the genetic doctor, and in that appointment, they did another ultrasound, a more specialized ultrasound. It was a very long ultrasound, and they were able to measure a bunch of things, and they then gave us a diagnosis.
And what was that?
That our baby had a very rare thing called Dandy-Walker syndrome, or Dandy-Walker malformation, which is when a part of the brain, specifically a part of the cerebellum, is missing. At first, they told us that the diagnosis is actually variable. Some babies are okay, and some babies, it's very, very severe for some people. With more information from the scan of the brain, they found a lot more evidence that in our child it would have been extremely severe. There was, yeah.
That's an awful lot to wrap your heart around.
Yes.
Your heart and your mind.
It was just really difficult to let it all sink in. And then after that, then they present an option.
So how was that presented? What options did you have?
So they said that based on the picture that they gave us, which was a child that would never be able to eat, to walk, to talk, to even raise his head up, to communicate even emotionally, that might need multiple brain surgeries as a baby because the head might have a lot of swelling. Seizures is a common thing. And so they presented this picture to us, which was extremely dire and which was no life for a child. It was a life of pain and suffering, and we didn't want that for our baby. We didn't want that for our child. And so they then presented different options of ending the pregnancy, which was also just, I didn't even have time to really let it all sink in. And the options were to have a procedure that's called a D&E, or a dilation and evacuation, which is basically an abortion procedure. Mm-hmm. And the other option is to induce labor and then deliver the baby.
So what did you go with?
So it was a difficult choice in many ways. One way, the D&E is a shorter process. It's, aside from the initial prep work, they give you anesthesia so you don't remember. And the other process, the induction and delivery, is a longer process. They have to induce labor, which can take, they said, up to 3 days, and it would be a hospital stay. It's more expensive. And luckily, our insurance covered these things, but they can be up to $10,000 for some women. Just that process of having to deliver in a baby that was no longer living was just something I didn't want in my memory.
So you knew in your heart that final decision was the right one.
Yes, I knew in a strange way it was the easiest and the most difficult decision of my life, because I knew what we had to do. As much as we wanted this baby, we felt this baby was ours. You know, he's our son. It's strange because from the outside I don't look like a mother, but I know that I am. I have a son. And
you had named him.
Yes. We named our baby Emerson. And the beautiful part of that name is that my husband and I had not agreed upon a name. And in the few hours after our anatomy scan, when we found out it was a boy, the name just popped into my head out of nowhere, seemingly out of nowhere. And we were so excited because we both agreed on the name.
And then a few hours later, you got the call.
Yes.
After the procedure, so you had the D&E.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about what you and your husband did to mourn this loss?
I did a lot internally in my own mind before the procedure. And my husband, we both said goodbye in our own ways to the baby before the procedure. After the procedure, there is an option to receive ashes from the hospital of the baby. I wasn't even aware. I didn't even think to ask that. But we met with the funeral director, and he said that they would be in charge of receiving the ashes, which took about 2 weeks. And at that point, we decided to go to Northern Michigan and release Emerson's ashes into the lake, because that was a place we went during my pregnancy that was full of happiness and joy. And swimming in the lake was just a really happy place for my husband and I. So we did a ceremony releasing his ashes.
And so now it's been almost 6 months.
Yeah.
How are you feeling now? Is there regret? Is there relief? What's inside?
There's no regret. I don't regret my choice. I believe that it was the only humane choice for my son and for our family. But I am filled with every emotion, and it varies day to day. And some days are okay, and some days are really, really difficult still. And I guess right now what I'm feeling is just this really intense need to share my story, to give a face to this story, because of the particular timeline of my own ending of the pregnancy happened just weeks before the election. And I was watching the debates, and the misleading and misunderstood things that our president said about abortion, that you could just rip the baby out of the mother's womb the day before the due date, is just completely untrue. And I really feel a need to tell the story of what it's really like for myself and for other women. There's thousands of us. There's probably more. I don't know the statistics of how many women are faced with this horrible diagnosis or any diagnosis and have to make this choice. And we need a voice, and we don't have one at this moment.
And you had commented that you'd seen a story in a leading New York Times, I believe, and the story was one way, but the comments struck you to that story, that there was a lack of compassion.
Yes, I think when the issue of abortion and specifically late-term abortion comes up, there is a huge lack of compassion, and I think that comes because people don't really understand what it is that we are all talking about. Because I remember years ago hearing the term late-term abortion, and though I've always been pro-choice, I thought, that's a weird term. That doesn't sound right. There's something wrong with that. It doesn't seem right. That, you know, people might ask, well, why would people wait so late? I've heard that. Why would you wait so late to have the procedure. But the truth is that it takes until 20 weeks for the doctors to do that anatomy scan to detect most of the problems that might be presented. And I had a genetic blood test at 15 weeks, which came back normal, and it can't detect everything. And so it's really important that people understand that women aren't just waiting till they're halfway through their pregnancy and deciding for some reason they just don't care, they don't want it. They are faced with a choice, and it is the most difficult choice.
Now, I'm interested in what you've heard from others in your circle or in your community or in your family who maybe have some strong religious or moral objection to abortion in any way, shape, or form.
So I feel lucky that the people in my family and in my community are all really supportive of my choice. I am connected with other women in support groups who have not had the same luxury of the support of their families and how difficult that is. But I can say that I do see anti-abortion protesters on the street. And there was this one moment shortly after the ending of the pregnancy that I saw protesters on the street and I became so angry. I just wanted to yell. I wanted to honk my horn. I wanted to do something. And something inside me said, go and talk to those people. And so I don't know what it was, but it was just this need that I didn't want to hate the other, because to me they were the other, and that was what much of the election was based on, was casting people into otherness and then finding them different and not accepting them. And I thought, these people are good people. They have their own points of views. Nobody's wrong here, but let's just share stories.
Did you go talk to people?
So I did. I went and I talked to those four protesters, and I pulled my car over and I said, hi, my name is Rachel. I want to share my story, and I want to see where you have a place for me in your opinions and your mindset. I need to know how you can make space for me. And I told them the story, and I was really amazed. They stepped forward and offered me nothing but love and compassion, and even gave me a hug through the car window. And they asked me how I was coping with my loss. And they said, we're not here to judge you. We're here to love. And we talked about suffering. And one of the men said that, you know, sometimes life is about suffering. And I said, I know, but to me, I chose my own suffering over the suffering of my child. And I think that is what a mother does, is she makes choice on behalf of her children when they can't make it for themselves. They asked if I wanted to pray with them. And I said, well, I'm Jewish, but sure, a prayer is a prayer. And they said something, it was beautiful, it was about love and loss and healing. I don't remember exactly. And the one man said, all five of us will be forever changed from this interaction. And
that took some courage to roll that window down and say something.
It's strange because it did, but it also just, it wasn't a choice. It was just something that came over me to do, to say. And it healed something in me, because I learned that if we get to know the people we think are the other, we think are the enemy, we feel like we hate, we learn that we probably won't hate them so much.
And I know you said that you don't want to change people's lives,
right,
but you just want people to be more compassionate.
Yes. I just think that if people know the stories of what it's really like to have to be faced with the choice to end a pregnancy, that maybe there will be more awareness around the issue and it won't be thrown around so insensitively and so with so many assumptions and misunderstandings. And I understand why women don't talk about this. It's not a safe place to talk about ending a pregnancy, and I'd like to hopefully make space for more women to come forward. And I'm part of a community now where more women are stepping up and sharing their stories in amazing ways, and they inspired me to share my own.
What would the overturning of Roe v. Wade mean for us from your perspective?
It would be devastating. You really can't know what it's like until you are in that, in those shoes, in that person's shoes. And even myself at 15 weeks, when they asked if I wanted to do a genetic screening, at first I thought, I don't know, because there could be nothing that could be presented to me that could make me want to end this pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And so even my 15-week self could not understand my 21-week self that chose to end the pregnancy.
And there will be people, and you may have encountered them already, that will say, no matter what, that baby needed to be born and let life play out as it will.
Mm-hmm.
How do you answer that? Because you had to wrestle. That's the question
Yes.
you had to wrestle with, wasn't it?
Yes. So I don't know if this is a little too woo-woo or out there,
okay.
But so I feel very connected to what some people call God, what I might call the universe, what many different definitions for that. And I was lucky enough to have a dream the day after the anatomy scan, where I got to talk with my son, with my baby, and he asked me why he couldn't stay with me. And I told him, we love you so much. Your father and I love you so much, but we can't bring you into this world in a broken body. We have to let you go so that you could come back in a healthy body. I think people say that, you know, we just have to let life unfold as it does, but I think that I did in my own way. And to me, this is how it was meant to be.
Rachel, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is the first week that truly, truly feels like summer. Stateside's Lise Mesmer headed out to ask Michiganders just what makes this season so special in our state.
What do you most look forward to about Michigan summers?
Actually, I think the light, the way the sun shines, I feel like you can tell that we live near lakes.
I think I just like to see everything grow. I just love the green and the colors.
Being outdoors all the time, going for runs and hikes and swimming in the rivers, it's amazing.
Being outside, gardening. You know, what I really look forward to is that when I walk out of my car, it doesn't hurt.
We generally go up to Elk Rapids and ride bikes.
Lots of hikes. Yeah, lots of hikes. Yeah, drink some good white wine.
Yeah.
Sangria.
Yeah.
Hike with the wine.
Yeah, exactly.
I like to go up north.
Oh, we always go to Leelanau.
I try to go up to Traverse City.
I don't know. There are many recommendations.
Yeah, we go up to the Houghton Chassel area up by Lake Superior. We have family, but we spend a lot of time at the beach looking for like gemstones at the beach, like agates, and hiking and all that good stuff.
I have a place way up in Copper Harbor, and it looks over Lake Superior and another small lake, and it's heavenly.
We know what it's like to be freezing, so when it's nice and we're warm, we're so appreciative, you know?
And that's today's Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.